Welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show, live from the island of Laguna Beach. And we have three entranceways to Laguna Beach today. It's beginning of Memorial Day weekend, and now we only have two because some drunken idiot knocked a telephone pole down and a power pole down in Laguna Canyon on the biggest weekend of the year. So we got a real jam here going. Also, welcome 1340 AM FM and Tan Talk Radio, Voice of Tampa Bay. And we're going to have some fun tonight. We have Kathleen Martin on, a niece of Betty Hill. We have my old friend and dear hard-working physicist buddy, Stanton Friedman. And they're both going to be on tonight. We're going to be using the quick chat, and we'll probably take some call-ins later on. But without any further ado, let me first introduce ladies first. Kathleen, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Are you having a good evening? I know it's 9 o'clock your time. The sun's probably already gone down.
Oh, it's dark here.
Yeah, it's dark. We haven't even got sunset yet. Stanton, are you there?
I'm here.
Well, it's good to see, hear you, actually. I look forward to seeing you one of these. I haven't seen you in a while.
So I guess, I'm the same old guy I was before.
Yeah, you sound like you got more energy than you used to have, though. What's your secret? UFOs?
Sure. I give a lot of college lectures, so I'm around young people, you know.
Yeah, it's really rubbing off. It really is. So anyway, now the book is out, right? Your new book, Captured?
Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience by Kathleen and myself. Yes, it's out. It's selling like hotcakes, they tell me.
That's great. By the way, I want to congratulate you on Larry King the other night. Before we get into the book, we had that little chat the other day. Tell us about Mr. Skeptic that we all see. What did you do to Mr. Skeptic?
Well, I watched the, when you're on the show, you pay no attention to anything except listening to see what people are saying, so you're ready to jump, so to speak.
Right.
But I watched the show the day before. I did a three-hour debate with Mr. Skeptic, Dr. Shermer.
Dr. Shermer,
on
right.
The Coast to Coast radio show. He was the guy sitting next to me on the Larry King show. And it was amazing how many people emailed me and said, how come you didn't just punch him out?
Yeah, there you go. That's the way to do it.
And I said, that's not my style. But when we did the debate, we did 3 hours on August 1st,
right.
18 days later, and he hadn't learned anything more than the little he knew when he was on the King Show, and they took a vote at the end of the 3 hours, and it was 80% for me and 20% for him. And when we were on with Larry King, as you know, there were too many people on.
Yeah, there was a lot of people on. Did you get to talk to Larry off air?
Just a tiny bit. He was coming out. He had done two shows in a row. He had done one on medical stuff just before our show.
Oh, okay.
So he was going off that set as I was coming on, and I said, pointed out that we had met in the desert back about 1994.
Over at Area 51?
Yeah, near Area 51 and that strange show we did out there. And he said, I remember the face. And that was about the only... he was going by, I was going in, and then afterward, there was no chance to talk to him. I had actually done a radio show with him about 25 years ago in Washington, D.C. But, Larry's a busy guy, and wonder how many thousands of people he's interviewed over the years.
I know, it's like everybody on the planet that has a name that somebody else has heard, you know?
Well, amazing. He's only a little older than I am, so we're both still going strong. I'm in better health. I haven't had any heart problems, and I haven't been in any hospital, spent any hospital time in my life.
You had any more kids? He's still producing a few of those.
Well, he's got more of those than I do, I think. But,
yeah, that's funny.
But the show, I was surprised how much attention it got. They re-ran it twice, as I understand.
Oh, yeah. No, that's good. I mean, I watched that. I was glued to the set as you were on there.
And, that was a causative factor. The mayor of my fair city here, of Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's the capital of the picture province of New Brunswick, the home of the University of New Brunswick, which is the oldest English language university in Canada. And partly because of that, last Monday night, the 27th of August, they declared, and I have a certificate to prove it, framed from the city council and the mayor, they declared it Stanton Friedman Day.
I saw that on the internet. We put it up on one of the TNT boards at BBS Radio, which congratulations on that. You know, you deserve that.
Well, you know, what was strange to me was, you know, Fredericton isn't a big town, 50,000.
It's named after me, you know, Frederick.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's okay. You know, you get the glory, I get the name, you know.
Well, it's only got 50,000 people, but because of an article in the Canadian press the day before,
yeah,
I did a whole slew of interviews all day Monday. I did some on Tuesday. The article appeared in many cities across Canada. I did French language people. My neighbor complained that there were three media trucks in front of my house that day. Couldn't get through the street.
That's way cool.
Well, it was interesting. And today I went out, went to the bank and to the mall, and everybody's saying nice things. It's a small town. I've been here 27 years.
Yeah, Stanton, you deserve it, man. I worked with you for probably 25 years for all the shows we've done together, and you have worked your butt off, and you have faced one skeptic, one idiot after another forever. You know what
well,
I mean?
The idiots will always be with us,
yeah.
And there's nothing we can do except my approach is take them on head on, because
yeah.
When you scratch a debunker, you find somebody who's putting down what he isn't up on.
And, yeah, exactly.
You know, you can handle that. If they had any information, it would be interesting. But I've done debates at Oxford University and won there, too. And there again, the guy didn't know anything.
Yeah.
I'm not saying there aren't two sides to many aspects of ufology, but only that the debunkers don't bother doing the homework. It's don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up.
Yeah, before I bring Kathleen, I have a question. I saw that UFO thing from Haiti. It looked to me like a hoax. Did you see that thing from Haiti?
Yes, and yeah. I've seen the admission or the confession or whatever you want to call it from
yeah.
the guy who made it. He's a special effects specialist.
That's what I thought.
Somebody had caught the fact that the trees were all the same, the pattern on the palm trees, and that is very suspicious, of course, because nature doesn't seem to work that way in general. So what are you going to do? The hoaxers will always be with us.
Oh, yeah, it was some pretty clever stuff. He had two other ones he had on YouTube or someplace, too. Looked pretty good. Looked like he was getting ready to go to work for Spielberg that day or something, you know? So, Kathleen, how are you doing, dear?
I'm fine.
So what's it like to be, the niece of a fairly infamous and well-known lady who was married to a guy that, you know, was, as you were telling me the other day, had tremendous political power on this planet. We had no idea. How is that working out for you?
Well, it's just always been a part of my life, so it's no different than it ever has been.
Yeah,
except now you've got a good book out that you did most of the work on.
Now I have a book out about them, so...
Yeah, tell us about the book a little bit. What some of the chapters and the overall, what it's about. Just tell us about it, because we want to know. I know you probably talked about it a bunch, but I got a bunch of different listeners in the other shows on this network.
Well, I took several different approaches to the book. First of all, I wanted it to be Betty's biography.
Right.
So there's a tremendous amount of biographical material in there, and the content of hours and hours of interviews that I did with her over an extended period of time. She also gave me all of her files and her diary entries, her memoirs, technical reports on all of the scientific research that was done on her case.
So you have all that now?
Yes.
You have that all in a safe place?
The University of New Hampshire has it now.
Okay.
I established an archive there.
Good.
And she also gave me the hypnosis tape that she and my uncle had with Dr. Benjamin Simon, a highly esteemed psychiatrist in Boston who had a great deal of success in working with victims of shell shock during World War II.
Right.
And he used hypnosis, and his technique was so refined that he had a higher level of success than the other psychiatrists. He ended up getting the patients who had failed with other psychiatrists and was able to heal them. So he was very, very competent at what he did. He was also a skeptic.
And, about UFOs, that is.
Yeah, about UFOs. About, not about human beings.
About UFOs.
Yeah.
So I do have in a bank vault now all of the audio tapes of the hypnosis. And when I was writing the book, I transcribed all of the tapes for comparative analysis because I wanted to find out for myself whether or not Betty and Barney had actually been abducted.
Right.
I could accept the UFO sighting part.
So you were a bit skeptical in your own reserve.
Pardon me?
You were a little bit skeptical yourself.
I was skeptical because I had read all of the skeptical articles and arguments, and I knew that Dr. Simon was somewhat skeptical, too, although he said you couldn't prove it one way or the other. He thought that the possibility existed that Barney had simply absorbed Betty's dreams. She had had five dreams a couple of weeks after the sighting.
Right.
Part of those dreams were part of her biographical memory of the trip home and the sighting, and another part of those dreams was of an abduction.
Right.
So the hypothesis was that Betty might have absorbed Betty's dream material.
Barney might have.
Barney might have, sorry.
Yeah.
And thought that made it part of his own biographical data and talked about that under hypnosis, came to believe that this had really happened to him when it hadn't. So I did a comparative analysis on that, and it was very, very interesting.
So now how do you feel about it now in your heart of hearts? How do you feel about what happened to your aunt?
Well, what I found was independent testimony by Betty and by Barney. Now, when Dr. Simon hypnotized them, he imposed amnesia. He hypnotized them separately, and they couldn't even remember what they said. So there's no way they could have discussed that information with each other.
Right.
But I found a tremendous amount of information that was not in Betty's dream, but it was in Betty's hypnosis and also in Barney's hypnosis. And it was contradictory to what the dream material said.
Right, right. I can dig that. Yeah, I understand. That's pretty amazing. What did you think on this? Stanton, how did you meet her anyway? How did you meet Kathleen?
Well, I'd met Kathleen years ago. More importantly, I'd met, in a sense, I had met Betty and Barney way back in 1968 in November in Pittsburgh. They came to town to do a television show for Westinghouse Broadcasting,
right.
And I had done a talk show on Westinghouse, KDKA Pittsburgh, a number of times, and they let me know that Betty and Barney were coming to town and where they were staying, so I called and arranged to have dinner with them. Because I had read the John Fuller book, Interrupted Journey.
Right, I remember that book.
It was a bestseller, and then I read the two articles in Look magazine, also by John, and the case was kind of, the only way I can put it, was in my gray basket. Maybe.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you, what basket was it in? Gray basket, I got it, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, at that time, up to that time, there had been stories about people claiming to, you know, the contactee literature, and others, there were stories about bodies hither, thither, and yon. Robert Spencer Carr made noises and stuff, but nothing that seemed to have any substance to it. And NICAP, I was a member of NICAP, National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, and APRO, Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, and NICAP seemed to be taking the stand that, yeah, there are these alien spacecraft flying around the planet, but there's nobody on board.
Oh, wow.
they tried to avoid dealing with the alien beings. So meeting them and spending a few hours with them was very impressive to me. They were obviously sensible people. They weren't looking for anything. They weren't bragging about anything. They weren't seeking attention. And I was impressed. And so it was really nice when I got a call from Carl Lorenzen of the Aerophenomenon Research Organization.
Remember him, yeah.
And she told me that there was a woman named Marjorie Fish who had visited Betty.
Right, the star maps.
Yeah, and who was working on building three-dimensional models that might enable us to find out what the heck that star map meant, if anything.
Now, was that a view of Theta Reticuli from space or from a terrestrial point? Where was the viewpoint from?
Well, it was definitely from space.
Okay.
Definitely right. From the aliens' viewpoint. Not
so they were out there somewhere when this star map came up.
Well, they were looking. We were toward the upper right-hand corner of this three-dimensional model, if you will, or a hologram or whatever you want to call it. And Marjorie's goal was to see if she could build the three-dimensional model and find a pattern that matched the two-dimensional drawing that Betty had made. I mean,
right.
There was that crazy conversation that's in the book, crazy in the sense that it's almost humorous. And Betty tells the guy, the leader, they're finished with her examination. Barney's still in the other room. She asks him where he's from, and in the understatement of the month, she says, "I know you're not from around here."
Right.
And so the alien shows her, opens up this hologram, for want of a better way of putting it, and she's looking at it.
Yeah.
All these points of light connected with three different kinds of lines, and there's heavy trade routes and light trade routes and occasional expedition. And Betty's looking at it and says, "Where are you on the map?" And wise guy alien, as I like to call him, says, "Well, do you know where you are on the map?" "No, I don't know anything about astronomy," Betty said. And he says, "Well, how can I tell you where I'm from if you don't know where you're at?" End of discussion.
That's now, a pretty cool intellectual switch. Yeah.
Well, you know what I get a kick out of is I'm wondering, you know, what did Dr. Simon think listening to all this business?
Yeah, I mean, Dr. Simon.
Well, it's bad enough. He's got two obviously sensible, intelligent, active in the community people who are telling him this crazy story, and it appears as they're reliving being taken on board a craft by aliens. Wow. But then to be talking about trade routes and occasional expeditions and a star map, oh, boy.
Yeah, that's got to really be out there in the, beyond Spielberg.
Before Spielberg. And
Simon, sorry, you're right. Spielberg was
Simon,
throwing diapers then.
Simon tells S. Betty if she can remember it accurately, and she says yes, or if she can remember what it looked like. He gives her a post-hypnotic suggestion.
Right.
To draw it later on, if and only if she could remember it accurately.
Wow.
And she goes home and she draws it. And I guess it was a while before she brought it back to him, but it's in the book, The Interrupted Journey.
I can't wait to get this book. This sounds to me like a movie. I think we should make a movie out of this if it's not already happening for you guys.
Well, we're waiting for offers, yeah.
Well, I'm gonna present this to my friend Peter Rappelson. I just got a big record deal. He writes for Madonna and Britney Spears and a lot of them his dad Samuel Rappelson was the guy that made silent movies talk, and then his dad Bob Robert Rappelson made a ton of big films, and he and I have become very good friends. I'm going to present this to him. I really am. Once I get a copy of it, I think there's a possibility of a movie deal here. I mean, a real quick, easy deal to get this. This is such a fascinating story. It's got so much history. It's bulletproof, as far as I'm concerned, on what happened. And I think if it was made into a movie, it would be awesome.
Well, you know, the first book, The Interrupted Journey, was made into a movie. The UFO incident was called by Universal Studios, and it ran on NBC in 1975. James Earl Jones played Barney. He had actually owned the movie rights. He doesn't anymore. I was hoping he'd want to redo it or put out a new DVD, and I've been in touch with him sort of indirectly through his agent. And
yeah, email me that information, because if I'm going to present this to Peter Rappelson and he wants to do a movie on it, we'll do it. you know, because I'm getting back in that business now. You know, this would be good. And the history of the how did that film do with Earl Jones? How did it do?
Well, it was on NBC television. It had very good ratings. And
yeah.
I was a consultant on the film, and I still get a kick out of the fact that Universal got my name from the United States Air Force.
Well, that's really good.
I was living in Southern California, and the general rule for the Air Force was, if somebody calls you about UFOs, refer them to a local scientist. Because we in the Air Force, we don't have anything to do with UFOs anymore. Ha, ha, ha.
Yeah, yeah. Alan J. Hynek and I had a radio show. He used to be on the radio show over at K-Fox back in the early 80s, and that's how I got to know him. And he just totally rebuffed everything that he put out when he was working on Blue Book. You know, he just rebuffed all of it.
Well,
you knew Alan J. Hynek, right?
I knew J. Allen Hynek.
J. Allen Hynek.
Oh,
right.
Yeah. I was in his home. I had to pass muster to get to see him the first time in the late 60s. He sent one of his buddies who had been at the University of Chicago, where I went to school, and where Alan went to school, too, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
But I didn't get my Ph.D., you see. So I had to pass muster. The guy came, and Fred Beckman came and heard me speak at a campus in town. And if he thought it was okay, then he would take me to see Alan at his office at Northwestern University.
Yeah, the arrogant cosmologist.
I passed muster, yeah. And I was visited with him many times after that. We were very different people, and I should stress, Alan suffered from a problem that most astronomers suffer from.
Yeah,
they think linearly, and you can't get here from there. He used to use as an example, if a playing card represents the distance between the Earth and the Moon, the nearest star is like 18 miles of playing cards away, so you can't get here from there. That's thinking linearly, but
right,
that's not how space travel works.
No.
If you're going to the Moon, for example, you know, the rocket only operates for a few minutes and you coast the rest of the way.
Right.
If you could double your velocity at burnout, you get there 20 times as fast, not twice as fast.
Right.
Because you're dealing with the difference between two quantities that are pretty close to each other. It's like running a business. If costs are 49%, so you got 51% in sales, the difference is 2%, but if you drop 1-2% and the other up 2%, you get a heck of a lot more profit from a little change.
Exactly. Once you get past overhead, then that's home free.
Yeah.
It's a free ride. Exactly.
So Alan always had a problem, as do most astronomers, with thinking that you can't get here from there. And you may recall that the British Astronomer Royal, way back before we got into space, said space travel was utter bilge.
Right.
And that wasn't too long before we were in space, but what the heck. What I'm saying is Alan was a great guy. He was a good teacher. I've talked to people who had him as a professor. He, as you know, didn't protest about the Air Force until he was no longer a consultant.
Right, exactly, until he got out. That's when I met him, and he was out. Yeah, 83 or 84, right around there.
Well, the Blue Book was closed in 69. So
yeah, I know.
It's gone then. But,
yeah, earlier.
He had a battle with Dr. James E. McDonald, whom I consider to be a much more effective investigator. He was thorough. But anyway, I got asked by Marjorie Fish, or Coral Lorenzen, to help Marjorie Fish. I arranged to see her when I was on one of my lecture tours. She lived in Ohio.
Now, how did that go? Tell us about that.
Well, it was great. She had sent me some handwritten materials before that, and I was impressed that this was a very thorough lady. Turns out she was a member of Mensa, and I was too, and so she was a bright gal, and
yeah.
I was very impressed with her objectivity. She didn't make crazy assumptions. She wasn't pushing a viewpoint.
Yeah.
She started off as skeptical because she didn't think aliens would look like us, you know, and they're basically humanoid. I mean, you'd recognize they weren't from here, except maybe in New York City or someplace, but where you could find almost anything.
Well, yeah, in New York City, yeah, you can find anything. That's true.
Yeah. So I also was with her in Chicago at the Adler Planetarium when she made a presentation to Alan.
Wow.
And then I helped explain her work at a Mutual UFO Network symposium in Akron, Ohio. So I was the first to publish with the woman named Bobby Ann Slate Gironda from California
yeah.
in Saga Magazine.
I remember that magazine. I got copies of that in my arc. You know, that's an old magazine. How cool
yeah,
is that?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It is, and they're not around anymore.
No, but I got a bunch of issues from them with everybody, like Dan Fry and everybody in there, you know?
Yeah, and I convinced the editor of Astronomy Magazine, whom I had met, Terrence Dickinson, to publish an article about Marjorie's work.
Right.
And he talked to her, and he talked to Dr. George Mitchell at Ohio State University, an astronomer, who verified that Marjorie's work was very accurate. She built all these models, 3D models. The hard part was the distance data. See, when an astronomer wants to look at a star, he just aims his telescope in a certain direction. It doesn't matter how far or close it is. But if you want to build a three-dimensional model, you need to know distances so you get things.
You got to look at it as a hologram.
Yeah, and so the distance data available back then was lousy because astronomers weren't going anywhere, and it's hard to measure from Earth very accurately anyway. She didn't find any patterns that matched until she built their umpteenth model, and she got a new catalog of distances, the Wilhelm Gliese catalog.
Wow.
And when she built that model, changed one of the other ones, there was the pattern.
Wow.
Angle for angle, line length for line length.
Wow.
Betty had drawn, and she was very excited, Marjorie was. And it turns out that that work has stood up very remarkably well. There's a new European Space Agency satellite, the Hipparcos satellite, that made millions, literally, of
wow.
measurements of distances to nearby stars. And so several important things. One is that all the stars in the pattern, the 16, the ones connected with lines, are the right kind for planets and life. Now, that's only true of about 5% of the stars in our local neighborhood.
Right.
Only 1 in 20, but all the ones in the pattern are the right kind. All the right kind of stars for planets and life in our local neighborhood are in the pattern. So you've got all the right kind and only the right kind. The chance of that being an accident is like 1 in 10,000 to 1 in a million, depending on whose statistics. Me being very conservative, only 1 in 10,000, you know.
No, that's amazing.
And
did Carl Sagan ever view this at all, went back when he was alive?
Well, as a matter of fact, Terry Dickinson's article in Astronomy Magazine got more response than anything they'd ever published before or since, and over the next year, in the mid-70s or early 70s, they published 11 more articles from various and sundry people, including two from Carl.
Okay.
And then they put together a 32-page full-color booklet that had the original article and all the subsequent articles, and they sold 10,000 copies in no time flat.
Oh, I believe that.
Now, that's never happened for an astronomical publication before, but they had Carl's name on the front along with the other contributors, and his lawyer threatened to sue them if they kept that. So they made me an offer I couldn't refuse, and I wound up with 18,000 copies of that booklet, and I wish I had a few thousand now.
Yeah, I'd like to have one.
I sold out last year, my last one, and Carl was not happy, but he, like the other critics, and some of the letters were supportive, they weren't all critical. Every single one of the critics misrepresented what Marjorie did and how she did it.
Wow.
And that's consistent with the terms of the attitudes of the nasty, noisy negativists, as I call them. And, you know, Carl and I were classmates for 3 years at the University of Chicago.
I did not know that.
We're sort of friends, we were, and I visited him at his home.
I had no idea.
Before he died, and we're in the same classes for 3 years. We grew up in adjacent towns in New Jersey, Rahway versus Linden, and I was born in July of 34. He was born in November of 34. So, you know, similar.
So Cancer and Scorpio. I love it.
Well, yeah, and so we disagree about UFOs. and a number of aspects of them. But the interesting thing is that Carl didn't do any UFO investigation.
Yeah, no, I know he, in his field, he did amazing due diligence, as you do in UFO field. Your website, by the way, it's
www.stantonfriedman.com.
Yeah, I was on there. I was looking at MJ-12, and I don't want to leave Kathleen out of the conversation because I want to talk to her more. But you know, over the years, you know, it took me a while to understand you because of where I was coming from a different field, but from NASA. But I mean, I have come to have such appreciation for your due diligence and your steadfastness in your, you know, absolute prescriptive way of accumulating facts. You know, you're scary, and that's good. That's what this field needs, because you know what I mean? You've always been scared. I love it. But, you know, in the early days, I was more shooting from the hip, because I'm a little bit younger than you, not much, but...
Yeah, you're younger than I. Everybody's younger than I.
Yeah, that's all right. You're going to outlive us all, man. You're such a great guy. I can't wait to do another show with you, or a UFO panel or something somewhere in some time, you know?
Yeah, I shouldn't say everybody's younger. I always ride Bud Hopkins, that he's a little older than I.
Yeah, good old Bud. What's happening with Bud? And what's, you know, I also wanted to find out what's happening with our old John Mack over at Harvard. I mean, what happened to those guys? You don't hear them much anymore.
Well, John is dead.
What?
He got killed in an automobile accident in England by a drunken driver. What was it, Kathy? 3-4 years ago?
Maybe. It was just after Betty died, I believe, and she died in 2004.
Was it a drunk driver or some NSA guy, you know?
No, even his family didn't. The guy was brought before a court of law. You know, it's an offense to kill somebody while you're driving.
Yeah, we call that a felony, yeah.
And I think the problem, and I've run into this, when I've been in England, I have to constantly remind myself to look in the correct direction for the cars and traffic. When you step off the curb...
Yeah, when you step off the curb, you just about get run over from the right every time.
Yeah.
Yeah, from the right-hand side. Believe me, I know that one, yeah.
He was it was late. He'd had a long day. It was kind of dark and out in the boonies. He was going to somebody's house. He'd just had a long day and very unfortunate. And, you know, John brought respectability to the field, and he had guts.
Yes.
He had guts because he took on Harvard. They tried to strip him of his tenure.
Professorship, yeah.
Yeah, and he took him on and won.
Yeah, he
fortunately.
Did.
Fortunately. Now, John wasn't really into extraterrestrial spacecraft.
No, I know that.
He had heard from other people that you can't get here from there, and he was kind of shocked. We shared the stage in Australia a couple of times, and I went on before he did, so he was kind of forced to listen to my talk.
Yeah.
And he was kind of surprised that, you know, I really thought there were nuts and bolts vehicles coming here from someplace else, and he was looking for a... Kathy, what would you call it? A more esoteric approach to what was going on? I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah, Kathy, by the way, when Stanton and I are talking, if you want to butt in and say something, just jump in, you know? Don't be bashful with us.
Well, people need to appreciate Kathy's work on this book. Not only that she did most of the work on the book, but that she was persistent and objective, and contrary to what some people might think, oh, she's just Betty's niece.
No, I didn't. From talking to her the other day on the phone, and her giving me the facts about Barney and the political stuff he did with Lyndon Johnson and all that, she's on it a lot. She's, you know.
Well, there's more to it than that. She also has been active in MUFON for over a decade.
Wow.
And she was in charge of certifying field investigators for MUFON.
Wow, I'm familiar with their process. Yeah, that's great.
So she is well into ufology, and of course we recognize Dr. Simon wasn't, and she's been able to correct stuff that only an insider could correct, like the notion that Barney and Betty watched science fiction movies, and Betty was a UFO, what did somebody call her? Not a UFO nut, but had a strong interest in crazy stuff and things like that. And
Which
Kathy, you'd say that that was nonsense, wouldn't you?
It is nonsense. Betty was not a science fiction fan. There was not one science fiction book in her house when she died. Carl Flock even investigated this and came out publicly and stated that she was not a science fiction fan. So, you know, that accusation was totally false. In addition to that, she really had no interest in UFO. She was interested in furthering social and political causes and was very busy with that. In addition to being very active with the family and with her church.
Well, she, remember, was, after all, listeners should be aware that she was a social worker. She was concerned about people.
Yeah.
And she had guts. I mean, let's face it, we're talking an interracial marriage. Barney was black, Betty was white. This is New Hampshire in 1961 when the experience took place.
Almost like the Inquisition back there in those days for that kind of behavior.
Well, you know that the movie...
Some states.
Well, yeah, it actually was against the law for black man and white woman in many states to be together, but...
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. There were miscegenation. What did they call it? I think that was it.
Miscegenation laws were not abolished completely until later in the 60s, 68 or something like that.
Well, when... In the movie, the UFO incident, when James Earl Jones and Estelle Parsons, who played Betty, they were actually in bed together in a couple of scenes, and,
right.
you know, just casual conversation, but it was the first time ever that there'd been a black man and a white woman in bed on television.
It's like one step beyond Bob, Ted, Carolyn, Alice.
Well, yeah, I mean...
It's the next step.
What I'm saying is this is a very special couple...
Yeah.
Who had their act together despite their different backgrounds. I mean, Betty's family, when did your family come over? 1635 or something like that, Kathy?
Yes.
And, you know, here's Barney, whose, what,
wow.
grandfather was a slave? I think it was his grandfather. Maybe great-grandfather. I don't know. But anyway, very different backgrounds. And you could see that in how they interacted with their abductors. Betty knew who she was. I mean, she was going to tell this guy that she wanted a souvenir. You know, she asked him questions, and where are you from? You know?
you think the abductors actually chose them because of their background? Or what? Do you have any thoughts at all about why they were chosen?
Well, I think the doctor and the leader were talking, and, hey, Joe, you need any more specimens?
Yeah,
I'm behind on my count. I need a couple more. Anybody out there? Yeah, I see a vehicle down there. Let's crank up the machinery. Oh, one's a man, one's a woman.
Yeah.
Anybody around? No, there's nobody out there. This is out in the boonies here, and let's go get them.
Yeah.
I mean, Kathy, I don't know if you think about it that way.
What do you think about that, Kathy?
Abduction. And I think that the reason that Betty and Barney were taken was because Betty had spotted this craft and showed interest in it. And she and Barney stopped the car to look at it three times. So it was following them, but I think that they attracted the craft's interest to begin with just by stopping. And, you know, the interior of the car was lighted when they were out looking at this craft through the binoculars. So
and
I think
one,
what
one
it was
thing,
to begin with. But there were reports that other people also saw the craft that night.
And one of the things that struck me, Kathy and I were both at the exact location where the abduction took place up near Lincoln.
Yeah, what did that feel like then?
It felt very unusual because what came home to me...
Yeah.
Now, Kathy had been there before, but I hadn't,
you hadn't
been at
yeah.
that location. And what struck me was that clearly the aliens were controlling Barney's actions. There was no way in the world he would have rationally gotten off the main highway onto a secondary road and then off the secondary road onto a tertiary road, a dirt road at the time.
Yeah.
Unless the guys upstairs were making it clear, and where they wound up was the only place in that area that was big enough for the craft to land. It was just an empty, sandy area. I don't know what was there before. When Kathy and I were there, there was a house that had already been built there, but that was recent.
I wonder if the people in the house knew what happened there.
No, they didn't.
Yeah, put
they
the value
did not.
On that place.
But that struck me that they, every government would love to be able to control the actions of other people at a distance without putting a gun to their head or a knife to their throat
Implant
or whatever.
City. Exactly.
And so it was clear. Barney fought off their, how would you describe it, Kathy, when he's looking through the binoculars and he's getting this message from the leader to stay put? You had a better description.
He was attempting to resist the leader's suggestions to him. We don't know if this was telepathic or it was through some type of communication device.
Yeah.
But Barney was beginning to lose control of his ability to carry out action, his own free will.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. And so it was extremely frightening for him. And with all of the energy that he could muster and bravery, he managed to pull those binoculars down from his eyes, because this leader kept saying to him, keep those binoculars up, keep looking, you won't be harmed. And Barney would try to reach down for the gun that he had in his pocket.
Wow.
He couldn't move his arms. He couldn't move his hands down to that gun.
Wow.
So he was becoming very frightened, and he felt that he was going to be captured. And finally, he was able to pull the binoculars down, breaking the strap in the process, and fled back to the car. Got in and told Betty that they were going to be captured, and the craft at that point had shifted from the field that it was in, and it was right over the top of the car. And as Barney went speeding down the road, all of a sudden they heard this what Barney called an electronic type of buzzing sound. Betty called it an electric beeping sound, but it seemed to bounce off the trunk of the car, and it caused the car to vibrate, and this vibration could be felt right through their bodies.
Wow.
And
sort of like Pat Flanagan's Neurophone, which I experienced at the bottom of my feet. You could hear sounds in my head. That's similar technology. Yeah, neural technology where it actually hits an object and goes into your psyche.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah.
So it was again understandable that Barney, as a black person, would be more concerned about being enslaved and under control and badly treated.
Yeah, Stan, this is just let me just throw this in for whatever. Native Americans. Not Native Americans, but Native, from Africa, the black people from, they have a sensitivity that a lot of us, don't have. And like in sports, when these guys, I work with the NBA players, and when they get on the right, when they get in the zone, they're just, we just can't touch them. You know what I mean? They're so amazing. And so they have this ability. And when they dance, they're some of these guys are some of the best dancers and women. It's just like they have they have a sensitive vibration that can be tapped on, and maybe that's what they were tapping on Barney, because they knew about, they probably know about the difference between Caucasians and different people on this planet. And they've been around, they've been coming here, so I think they must have tapped into that energy. That seems to be descriptive of, of what you're explaining here, if that makes any sense.
Well, whatever it was, the two reacted somewhat differently, and the interesting thing, one of the interesting things, was that Betty was much more resistant on, much less resistant on board the craft.
Wow.
But she had asked to be able to take, I'll call it a souvenir, a book that was there. She needed proof that this had happened. Nobody would believe her, and
well,
they let her
not.
Take a book.
Even now.
And then just before they get off the craft, they're being taken off, then they said that we have decided that you won't remember.
Right.
And
that might have been like the post-hypnotic thing or something.
Well, yeah, and Betty says, I will too remember.
She's fighting it, yeah.
She won in the long term, but for some period of time, over 2 years, they didn't remember what happened on board the craft. They remember the sighting,
yeah,
but not the abduction.
Yeah, that was the missing time.
Yeah, and so it's one of the crazy things people say, oh, they just got lost in the roads in New Hampshire. Now, Kathy, you live in New Hampshire.
You know, I have traveled that route probably 6 times, mapping it out, driving at the rate of speed that they drove, stopping at the stops where they stopped, and timing this and measuring this and looking at those roads. And they were traveling down U.S. Highway 3, the major north-south route through northern New Hampshire at that time.
What time of the morning was it?
This was about, between 11 o'clock and midnight.
So there wouldn't be much traffic on Highway 3 in New Hampshire, right?
No, there wasn't, because it was the off-season.
Yeah, okay.
They were traveling south on Route 3. They had gone about 14 miles south of the field where Barney got out of the car and looked at the UFO through his binoculars, when all of a sudden, on the hypnosis tape, he said, I have to make a turn. And he seems very, very perplexed by this. He said, I made a turn, and I don't know why I had to make that turn. And the next thing you know, he is crossing over a bridge, and he had to turn right onto State Highway Route 175. So this was not a narrow, winding road that he turned onto. It was a state highway. And then off the state highway, 2 miles from that bridge, he made another left-hand turn onto a gravel road, and shortly he was abducted.
He was almost going in a circle at that point.
Well, it wasn't a circle.
Well, 2 left-hand turns, right?
There was a left-hand turn, a right-hand turn, and then
a right-hand turn. Okay, I got it.
He was just making
a little map while you were explaining that.
On State Highway 175.
Okay.
After the abduction ended and they were released, he was back on State Highway 175, which ran parallel to U.S. Highway Route 3.
Did he remember getting there or not?
Pardon me?
Did he remember getting there, driving back? Did he, at some point, you know, he blacked out or what? What I don't understand is what. At some point, they left their bodies. They actually pulled the car over, right?
They actually pulled the car over and abducted them, yes.
Did they physically remember getting out of the car?
Under hypnosis, but not consciously.
Okay. And then when they got unconsciously, do they remember what happened? It's like they remember they were gone and they were still driving, or they were pulled over and they were back in their car driving again. How did that work, that little detail?
It was seamless.
Yeah, it sounds like it. That's like it's just.
They didn't know where that roadblock occurred or why there was a roadblock, but they always had a vague memory of a roadblock. And they just remembered that they were driving. They thought that they had lost this UFO, and then they were on Route 3 near Plymouth, New Hampshire, in the Plymouth-Ashland area. When they saw this, they thought it was that area where they saw this large, reddish-orange, fiery orb in the road.
Yeah.
And then they heard another series of buzzing or beeping sounds on the car. And this is when they regained full consciousness and began talking again. So they had this very long period of time where they weren't speaking to each other.
Interesting.
It's a fascinating situation, and how the aliens managed to control it. And here were two strong-minded people, and still they were able to control their behavior, keep them docile, as Kathy mentioned, Barney had a gun in his pocket.
Yeah. Why would he carry a gun, by the way, just out of curiosity?
Well, it's an interesting thing. He had been on a trip to Niagara Falls with his first wife and his two sons.
Right.
And he grew tired on the way home, and he had actually been to Detroit and Niagara Falls.
Right.
He pulled over to the side of the road for the night and thought at that time how he wished he'd had a gun to protect his family with.
Right.
You know, just from criminals. And so when he was packing to go on this trip to Niagara Falls with Betty, he thought of that, and Betty had a pistol. She liked to do target practice on my grandparents' farm.
Right.
And so he took that pistol and put it in the trunk of the car.
Yeah, it's kind of a subconscious, you know, maneuver that what people would do based on a past experience then, yeah.
That they didn't have much money. This was sort of an impromptu trip.
Yeah, well, I'm from Ann Arbor, and I know Detroit, and even those days was a rough town. So, yeah, it was not the normal town. You had to be careful there, yeah, even then. Yeah, I understand.
So he thought perhaps they would have to sleep at the side of the road again, and he would have this gun to protect them.
Yeah, and then today, believe it or not, I mean, I think you invoke that when you carry it, but at the same time, if you pull off Highway 99 in Northern California to a roadside stop, you got to be careful what's going to come in there, because in today's world, it's even worse than it was then. So I understand that. You know, thanks for explaining that.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Yeah, Stan, I have another question for you. It's a little bit off subject here, because we're running, got about a couple minutes left. By the way, before we do that, even could you guys, what kind of, how can people get a hold of you? You've probably done this before on this network, but Stan, give your website and then tell us about the book real quick. And
yeah, the website is stantonfriedman.com, and there it does have PayPal, and it lists books and articles. Some people will like Government UFO Lies, one of my favorite articles.
Yeah.
And the UFO Why questions and stuff. But there's an order blank. And the one advantage of buying through the website or from Kathy, and she'll give her post office box address, is that you get both our signatures. We've signed...
Oh, that's really cool.
Well, we signed a lot of these book plates. We didn't ship books back and forth. That's silly. But so if you buy from Amazon, which is fine, that's great, or Barnes & Noble or any other conventional bookstore, you won't get the signatures.
Yeah, no,
so
that's way cool. That's worth a lot of money.
And then, Kathy, why don't you give them your...
Okay. My name is Kathleen Marden, M-A-R-D-E-N, P.O. Box 93, East Kingston, New Hampshire, 03827. I accept checks or money orders in the amount of $18.99, and that will give you shipping and handling, and it will come priority mail.
Yeah, and I also have both your information's up on the BBS Radio website on the index page, front page. I'm going to leave that up, as I said, till the middle of next week. I don't know if you've seen that. Have you seen that yet, Stan?
But no, I haven't.
Well, go to BBS Radio. There's a really nice mugshot of you and Kathleen, and a lot of people, like 6 million people, will see that between now and the time I take it down. And I have one last question off the record here. The astronaut on Larry King. What the heck was wrong with him?
Buzz Aldrin? Well,
Buzz Aldrin, yeah. What was his problem? And is he sold out or what?
I don't know. I'd met him before, and
yeah.
I was surprised that he was on. I was thinking, gee, maybe there's going to be a revelation, because I was aware of his sighting on the way to the moon.
Yeah.
It had been reported before, and no big deal about it, except that you don't expect to see anything up there when you're, for the first time ever, leaving the Earth. You know,
yeah.
And going toward the moon. But he seemed to be hell-bent on spending time going over the rocket and all this kind of thing. And you could tell even Larry King got impatient with him. And you see, I knew that he had sued Charles Berlitz and William Moore for the first Roswell book, The UFO Incident. Bill and I did most of the work, but Charles wrote the book.
Yeah.
And he had sued them for claiming, or Maurice Chatelain claimed, that he had had a sighting on the moon, and it was going to hurt his reputation. He was suing them for libel, and he got a settlement from them. So I couldn't imagine that he was going to suddenly come out with a UFO sighting after winning that suit.
Yeah, that's what it was. I knew something switched his gears. You know, he lives down here by me, and he never used to be like that. I was just absolutely, you know, not very happy the way he behaved.
Well, many of the emails I got, they wanted to know why I didn't just punch out Michael, and they wondered
yeah.
what the heck was Buzz Aldrin doing on the show? He didn't have anything to say that was useful.
No, he didn't. Absolutely nothing.
It was a disappointment. But, hey, he's an old man. He's 5 years older than I am. So.
Yeah, I ain't that old. All right, guys, I got to go. You know, we're 3 minutes over the show limits, but this is a spectacular show. I want to have you both back on if you want to come back on, either together or individually, because this needs to go. I'm going to actually communicate with you guys, you know, off the show. I want to present this to my friend. I think this should be a movie, this new book, and I want to get a copy of it. So,
okay.
All right, thanks. This has been Dr. Fred Bell.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Stanton.
Thank you.
And thank you, Kathleen. This has been Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show on bbsradio.com and Tantalk Radio 1340. And I'm sorry we ran out of time. It's one of the best shows we've ever had, and look forward to seeing you guys soon. And here we go. We got to go.